my place in tech changes every day. But I don't fear the future, because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts, so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of the Fox Nomad Podcast. I'm your host, Fox Nomad. My guest today is Dr. Christopher Gardner. He's a nutrition researcher and the director of nutrition studies at the Stanford Prevention Research Center. He has also been involved with the American Diabetes Association and the American Heart Association. He is here to talk all about nutrition, what you should eat, what the latest fads are, what is the ideal diet, and if you're athletic, what should you be eating? He really helps break down basic nutrition understanding. I learned so much from this podcast. I think you are as well. So enjoy this episode with Dr. Gardner.
Thank you, Dr. Gardner, for joining the podcast. I saw an interview of yours, and I was really curious because I feel like nutrition is something, and eating, right? We all eat, and we all kind of need the same protein, carbohydrates, and fats. But boy, is there a lot of different, there's just so much, we're just bombarded with information, like carbs are bad, or we need this much. What are we getting wrong about nutrition? I think maybe we should start there.
Yeah. So the funny thing is, as controversial as it seems, so I serve on various dietary guidelines panels. So I've helped the American Diabetes Association, the American Heart Association. I just served on the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee. And all of those groups and others update their guidelines every once in a while after, oh, there's more evidence. Maybe we should reconsider this. And the rate of change in those guidelines is glacial speed. It is so incremental. It is so small. It's almost frustrating. And yet, with social media and social influencers, this is out. This is in. Everything you knew for 50 years is wrong. And I think one of the big problems here is clickbait, right? So it's a if we were to say, yeah, one more time, eat more vegetables and fruits, no one would look, right? Eat your beans. Eat whole foods. Don't eat junk food. So there have been some shifts in the world of nutrition. One has been from nutrients to foods to patterns. So that's sort of a true shift. For your listeners, you know, original nutrition science came about when there were acute deficiencies of vitamins and minerals. Have you ever had pellagra or beriberi or scurvy?
Nope.
I'm just going to bet you haven't. So those were the days when there was sort of, within a few months or a year, there was an onset of a deficiency disease that could be tracked down to a single nutrient. And they said, oh, wow, we need all these vitamins and minerals. Interesting. Now we don't have those. And now people sell a lot of dietary supplements for things that don't actually have a recommended dietary allowance. So all the vitamins and minerals have sort of this set number that you should get, but there's all kinds of pills, traditional Chinese medicine, herbs, supplements that might actually help you with your optimal health. But a big shift in the world of nutrition has been, we don't so much get acute onset deficiency diseases. We think of it more in terms of athletic performance or heart disease, cancer, diabetes. Those latter things for optimal health are much harder to understand because it takes decades for those to manifest. And so it's pretty easy for somebody to make a claim and say, oh, this shark cartilage, you should have shark cartilage with creatine and this mushroom blend to make sure you live to 100. Who can ever test that? That's like not a testable question, unless you randomly assigned 1,000 people to do it and 1,000 people to avoid it until they died. and you'd be dead before the study was over. And so it's kind of easy to make a claim that's hard to refute. And people are interested in nutrition. They like clickbait. They keep clicking. So if it's seed oils or ultra-processed food or high protein, and what's happened along the way is the folks making guidelines used to talk about you need fiber and you should avoid saturated fat, added sugar, and sodium. Those haven't changed forever, and they're boring. And people don't go to the grocery store to shop for nutrients. They shop for foods. So a lot of them shifted and said, oh, you should have foods. And then people kind of shifted to superfoods. You should have chia. You should have algae. You should have this food. And so people got a little carried away with foods and put them in bars. Go ahead and skip this meal and have this bar as a meal replacer that has a superfood in it. Now you don't even need a meal. Well, come on. Everybody intuitively can imagine that that's wackadoodle. How could you skip a meal and get it all in a bar or a pill? So now the health community's kind of moved to, oh, Mediterranean, vegan, vegetarian. There have been battles over low fat, low carb, sort of current battles over protein. Most of it's pretty set, but part of it is maybe it's your fault in your podcast, right? It's trying to make engaging topics for listeners in a world where health communication has really changed just in the amount of information available and sort of the echo chamber available. If you really want to eat steak and cookies, which it is not good for you, I can promise you, steak and cookies are not healthy, but they taste good. You could find a way, you could find a social influencer that was giving you a reason to enjoy those. But it would have to be completely out of the context of the full body of scientific literature that would say, here's the best thing to eat.
So it seems like, you know, the basic advice is pretty much the same now as it was 20 years ago, even further back, right?
Yes.
So what does the ideal diet look like? So if you're going to build like a generic template, which is a huge question, but
yeah,
I sort of have an understanding of what that might be, but I could be totally wrong. So what does that look like for the average person?
Okay, so I'm going to take you to a place you weren't going, but I'll go there first. So what if I came up with the perfect breakfast, the perfect lunch, and the perfect dinner? And I got every health professional to agree to it. And I said, this is it. This is what you should eat every day for breakfast, every day for lunch, and every day for dinner. You wouldn't do it. That would be boring.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So part of this is sort of a futile battle to find the optimal diet. And what's really more interesting is how versatile human beings are. We're actually really capable. So globally, my favorite example is looking at the Inuits in the Arctic, who really survived for long periods of time in the dead of winter with their kayaks, hunting down seals and polar bears, like pretty much all fat and meat. And then the Tarahumara Indians in Mexico, living in the mountain ranges, sort of famous ultramarathoners. They bartered all day long with neighbors and pretty much run a marathon every day, just back and forth bartering with their neighbors. They eat corn and beans. That's like 90% of their diet. And so for at times, the Inuit and the Tarahumara Indians were doing great. Completely different diets. Like, couldn't be more polar opposites. And now both of them are in trouble because both of them are eating packaged junk food. Mm-hmm. So they were eating their local foods in season, what they could find, whole foods. That's really probably the underlying thing. And the genie's out of the bottle and the toothpaste is out of the tube on that one, because we now have a global economy. You can eat anything, any season, anywhere. And that's so fun that nobody's going to go back to, oh, I only eat the foods that grow seasonally in my region. So to be honest, that's probably the best diet, and nobody's going to do that. So I think so one of my recent roles in the American Heart Association, which I think was pretty fun, the American Heart Association in 2021 updated their guidelines, and they really are almost no different at all from their 2006 guidelines. But somebody had an idea, and they said, look, now that since we've just updated them, maybe somebody should take all the popular diets and say, how much do the popular diets align with the American Heart guidelines, which haven't changed for years? And so I was the writing chair of that for the American Heart Association and had 9 incredible colleagues to work with. And first we had to define what those were. And so we actually sort of narrowed it down. There were sort of 10 categories of popular diets. And in some cases, there were a lot of different ones, but they all fit under one category. And so just for an example, there's a whole bunch of low-fat vegan diets that are promoted by various physicians that have a good social media following. So the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, Dean Ornish, the Pritikin diet, who else? The Fire Engine 2 diet. They're all actually kind of the same. They're all low-fat vegan diets. And then you have paleo and keto. At the very end of the extreme, there's the well-formulated ketogenic diet. There's the ketogenic diet. There's a very low-carb diet. And then there's a vegetarian diet that could be with eggs, with milk, with fish, pescatarian diet. Anyway, we lined all of those up, and we went through the 10 domains of the American Heart Association. And are you ready for a big kumbaya moment here? So what I thought was really interesting is all 10, including very polar extremes, agreed on 4 things. And one was more vegetables, and one was more whole foods, and one was less added sugar, and the other was less refined grain. All of them, all 10, said those 4 things, which would be really boring if that's, oh yeah, and everybody knows that, and everybody does it. I do think everybody knows it, but in the US, nobody does that. Almost no one eats a lot of vegetables, a lot of whole foods. Americans eat a crap ton of sugar and a lot of refined grains. So first of all, what's making me laugh here is there's a lot of fringe things to do. Eat seed oils or avoid seed oils, avoid ultra-processed foods, eat protein, eat meat, eat this other thing. Most people don't even get the basics right. There's 4 things that everybody agrees on. And most Americans, anyway, don't eat that way. And then there's 6 things that almost everyone agrees on, but not quite everybody. So I bet this would align more with what you were just thinking, that you think you know as a rational person most of the things that are good. So the first would be beans. And really the appropriate overarching botanical name is legumes. So when was the last time you used the word legume? Have you used that word?
It's been a while. I think I would just say beans, yeah.
Or pulses is another word. So the botanical thing is legumes means fresh beans and peas, or peanuts or soy, or pulses, and pulses means dried beans or peas, and chickpeas or lentils. And there was a lot of lentils. That's a mouthful. So you could say legumes, but nobody would know what you mean. I have a friend who's really pushing beans, and he considers himself part of the Leguminati, an organization to push legumes. Environmentally, legumes are very cool because they all fix nitrogen in the soil. So they're actually part of an environmental solution to have less fertilizer. There's a guy named Gundry who says, oh my God, legumes and beans are full of, oh my God, why am I blocking on this? Lectins. And lectins are poisonous. Oh my God, don't eat lectins. As soon as you cook the beans or prepare them, most of the lectins are gone. And there's so many good things in beans that it would be silly to avoid beans because of lectins. So almost everyone agrees on legumes or beans. Let's say beans for your listeners, but it really is legumes. Okay, next, fruit. So the keto group really doesn't like fruit because it's carbs. Mm-hmm. Almost all the calories in fruit is carbs. And fruit has sugar. But you can even go to the Diabetes Association and they promote not a lot, but whole fruits, not fruit juice, especially not fruit juice without the pulp. But the sugar in a whole fruit is tied up in the matrix of the food. And the biggest part about sugars is how fast you digest it and get it in your bloodstream. And with fruit juice, it's very quick. But if you're just having a whole fruit, everybody agrees on fruit. Even the keto group allows berries, mm-hmm. but they don't really allow the other ones. Okay, so got legumes, got fruits, and then we got nuts. So the low-fat vegan group is a little opposed to these because nuts are really high in fat. And if you were to eat a lot of nuts, it would be high in calories. But the fat in nuts is unsaturated, except for a couple. So the macadamia nuts are a little high in saturated fat. But nuts in general, oh my gosh, nuts make foods great. Nut butters is a great way to add things. Oh my God, a peanut sauce on Indonesian food. Ah, okay, so almost everyone agrees on nuts. The next one I'd go to is eggs. Eggs have a lot of cholesterol in them. Oh my God. And cholesterol blocks the arteries in your heart and gives you a heart attack. But if you track down the metabolism of eggs, even though it does have a lot of cholesterol, your liver actually makes a lot of cholesterol every day. And when you eat an egg, the cholesterol goes to your liver before it goes anyplace else in your body. And if the liver, once the liver receives that cholesterol, it knows it has it. And it makes less. So interestingly, even though eggs are high in cholesterol, saturated fat raises your blood cholesterol more than dietary cholesterol. There's a little missing link between dietary cholesterol and blood cholesterol. And especially in the US, where we eat a lot of crappy, sugary cereals. I eat oats for breakfast, not crappy cereals. For the people eating sugary cereals, eggs would be much better than crappy, sugary cereals. So you could probably get most people to agree on eggs in the health community, unless it's cheesy eggs with sausage and bacon. That's not the same eggs as scrambled eggs or a hard-boiled egg. The next one would be fish. You know, vegetarians don't eat anything with a face. Fish have faces. So they're opposed to that. Almost everybody in the health community agrees fish are a healthy source of food. Then we have to talk about farm fish and wild caught fish and what are you feeding them if it's farmed fish and where's the waste going? There's some issues there, but wild caught fish are expensive, but fish, almost everyone agrees on fish. And the last one I'd put in there is yogurt, not dairy as a whole, but yogurt, given the interest in the microbiome and the gut and fermented food, I do have a problem with all the yogurts in the grocery store that are blackberry, peach, guava, or blackberry, peach, guava. And when you look, it's full of sugar. It's like low-fat, organic yogurt. But as soon as you look in the back, you say, ah, this isn't plain. This is full of colorings and sugar. So if you get a plain yogurt and put your own fruit on it and nuts, it would be great. So after those first four that I mentioned, almost the whole health community is on board for beans/legumes, fruits, nuts, eggs, fish, and yogurt. That's a lot of agreement right there. The next one I go to is probably whole grains, which gets a little complicated because most people in America eat refined grains and don't even really know what whole grains are, but whole barley, whole oats, brown rice. I make a really good wheat berry salad. What's a wheat berry? That's the whole kernel of wheat. It's not wheat flour. Oh my God, we eat so much pizza crust, bread, bagels, pastries. Okay, so I'm assuming none of this is news to you. You've heard like, sure, I've heard all those things are good for me. So at one level, isn't that super boring? But on the other level for me, it's like, how can people say nutrition is so confusing? When if you got a bunch of health professionals in a room and they were looking at the literature, they said, ah, there is evidence to back this up. It's solid evidence. It's supported by cultures around the world that have eaten all those things for thousands of years. And it's not a protein bar. And it's not a supplement of garlic. It's real garlic and onion in a dish you just made.
So I have a question about the whole grains, now that you mentioned it. So if you were to, and this is a broad question, but like, let's say you get a cereal that says whole grains, oats, whole grain, this, is that the same thing? Or are they kind of, you know, doing some wordsmithing on us? In other words, is that not the same thing? I'm, you know, when I imagine whole grains, I imagine like a bag of muesli or something like that with the actual, you know, the flakes of wheat in there, but something like a cereal where it doesn't look like it's just loops or something like that, you know, is that the same thing?
Okay, so let's take that a couple levels, and breakfast cereals are the best place to do it. So let's say you got a whole grain flour that you're making something out of. Another one for me is Cheerios. Mm-hmm. Cheerios is whole oat flour. And Cheerios has the American Heart Association seal of approval. Okay, but there was the basic Cheerios, and then there's frosted Cheerios, where they added a ton of sugar. And then recently, they made cookies and cream high-protein Cheerios. WTF. Oh my God, what was the matter with Cheerios? They're sort of, you know, these companies with their quarterly reports to their investors have to show, yes, I got a little bigger piece of the American stomach when I order it, when I created cookies and cream, protein Cheerios. A few more people bought Cheerios, when in fact, now they're sort of ruining it. So oats is one of my favorite examples. I've been eating steel-cut oats for years, and my father-in-law gave me a hard time because I was being very condescending, saying, hey, I only eat steel-cut oats. And he said, why don't you eat groats? And I said, what? And he said, groats, that's actually the term for the whole oat. Those steel-cut oats that you're eating are processed. They chopped them up a little bit. I've been eating groats for the last couple of years. I don't honestly think it makes much of a difference because the steel-cut oats are only oat kernels chopped up just a little bit. But picture for oats, you can get rolled oats that you can't cook quickly. You have to cook for like an hour. You can also get quick rolled oats that cook in 3 minutes. So that's more processed. They've done more. They've boiled them already. They've done part of the digestion for you. So if you go from the oats, so from the groats to the steel-cut oats to oat flour, we go from the oats to the long-term rolled oats to the quick rolled oats. Those are all whole oats. They didn't take anything out. But you're disrupting the original food matrix more and more each time. So I'm hoping this answers your question. There's a big thing right now about ultra processed food.
Mm-hmm.
There's a guy in Brazil named Carlos Montera who has proposed this. And I think he did a poor job choosing this term, because in my mind, going from the groats to those things that I just mentioned, those are all processing levels where you physically change. It no longer looks like a kernel of oat or wheat on a stalk of grain. But his contention is the issue isn't actually the processing as much as it is the chemical additives. He actually calls them cosmetic additives. The emulsifiers, the flavors, the colorants, the cookies and cream, high protein Cheerios, I think it isn't a problem that they used oat flour, because they might have used whole oat flour, and they can call it a whole grain cereal, because I think this is where you are going.
Mm-hmm.
And then they added sugar, and then they added color and flavor and cookies and cream and pea protein. And it was just supposed to be oat cereal. And they made they just kept doing things to it. So it's not just whole grain. So another I think this might really help answer your question. A lot of health professionals I know have switched the terminology to whole intact grain. Not just whole grain, whole intact grain. So when you pour that muesli cereal out, oh, I see the whole, I could recognize that thing in my bowl, as opposed to the cookies and cream, high protein Cheerios. You can't see oats anywhere in that.
Mm-hmm.
You can see colors and flavors. And you could probably, I guess there's oat flour in there somewhere. There might even be whole oat flour. But at this point, I can't recognize it anymore.
Yeah, so, and you bring up an interesting point, which is the big topic, I think, lately, which is protein, right? So you'll see protein in something, but it won't, you know, they won't mention that it has a ton of sugar, and so on. So if you, like you said, if it says whole grain Cheerios, it may have all these other things in it, which negates the fact that they're using something which could potentially not be so bad for you, right?
Yeah.
So here's, I guess, a question a lot of people have, and I'll ask it in general, and then I think I'll narrow it down to vegetarians and vegans. Are we getting enough protein in our diets? Like, as just a basic, my initial reaction is probably not, right? So I would assume most of us who are eating a normal diet, whatever that might be, are getting enough protein, because we're all getting, probably the biggest concern we have is getting too many calories. So I'm assuming a percentage of that is protein, and so that we're getting enough. But maybe I'm wrong.
No, there's no protein issue in the U.S. There's pockets of the world where they don't get enough food. If you don't get enough food, you might be protein deficient. I have a textbook. I'll just cut to the chase and then we'll go back. Mm-hmm. My textbook of nutrition says the interest in protein is a theoretical interest only. If you had no meat, no pork, no poultry, no fish, no dairy, no cheese, you would be hard pressed. You'd have to work at it to not get enough protein in your diet, unless you were really working at it. Unless you're like, I'm going to mathematically find all the lowest possible sources of protein to see if I can make myself protein deficient. So there's protein in everything. There's protein in all plants. There's a big myth that plants are missing amino acids, which are the building blocks of protein. They're not. I have a graphic that I put on social media that went viral. So an interesting thing, if it's okay to get into the weeds here, sure. The building blocks of proteins are amino acids. And there are 20 of them. And the analogy that I like to use is a Scrabble board. Almost everybody that I talk to has played Scrabble at one point in their life, and they know there's a bag of letters you have to draw from. Not many people have counted those letters. There's 100 in the bag. And at least in the English alphabet, there's 26 letters. So if there's 100 letters and 26 alphabetic letters, it seems like there would be four of each one. But we all know there aren't four Z's and four X's. There's only one Z and there's only one X. And amino acids are the same way. So in Scrabble, there's a whole bunch of vowels and there's a whole bunch of R's and N's. In protein, there's a lot of lysine, there's a lot of leucine, there's very little methionine and tryptophan. It's kind of like writing words and typing. You need very few of some amino acids and more of others. So it's not actually the total amount of protein that matters. It's the distribution and the proportion of amino acids. So somewhere along the way, the Dairy Council and the Meat Council and the Egg Council got a hold of this and said, oh, you're going to really need your meat and your dairy because animal products have the perfect proportions of amino acids and plants don't. And it makes sense. Plants don't have hair. Plants don't have organs. They don't make the same things that mammals do. But what's really striking is if you take any plant and the protein in it and you graph the proportions of amino acids, they are almost identical in plants. It's almost magical or mystical when you look at this thing. Clearly, there's less protein per gram of calorie in plant food, if you wanted to get, because meats and dairy, meats in particular, have no carbs. Plants always have carbs. So per calorie in meat, you are getting more protein. But all the amino acids are there. The way to address the myth is to agree grains are a little bit low in one of them, lysine. Beans are a little bit low in one of them, methionine. The rest of the proportions are almost identical. There is something where a lot of cultures across the world ate beans and grains together. And it turns out the grains that are low in lysine have a little extra methionine. And the beans that are low in methionine have a little extra lysine proportionally. When you eat them together, the proportions are even more animal-like than if you only ate grains or if you only ate beans. So theoretically, from an academic point of view, there is something there. But it only matters if you needed 40 grams of protein total and you only got 40 grams. And you only got it from eating chickpeas. That's all you ate all day. You wouldn't actually get enough protein. You'd be missing some methionine. But if you ate chickpeas and brown rice and Christopher's wheatberry salad, and you had other foods all day, most Americans get 90 or 100 grams of protein a day. So the proportions don't matter. If you're eating way more than you need, because all plants have all 20 amino acids, you get them. If anybody who's listening has ever watched Game Changers, the documentary, it's all about elite vegan athletes. And part of the reason they get enough protein is as competitive athletes, they eat a lot of calories. And even though it's plants, they eat a lot of calories and protein. And even though the lysine's low in grains and the methionine is low in beans, it doesn't matter because they don't eat 40 grams of protein. They eat 100 or 150 grams of protein. So even the normal vegetarian or vegan is fine for protein. And the other sort of odd thing is all these people are freaking out and having three breasts of chicken and a protein bar and putting protein powder on everything. They're all getting way more protein than they need. And there's no place in your body to store it. Once you've met your needs for the day, it all gets converted to carbohydrate, which is really funny because if you were to overeat, I think this will be intuitive for most people. If you were to overeat fat, you have an unlimited capacity to store fat in your belly, in your butt, in your jowls, in your face, everywhere. I'm sure you have some athletes listening in, and they probably know we have a limited capacity to store carbs. So you can store some in your liver, and about two-thirds of your stored carbohydrate goes in your skeletal muscle. So if you're running, from an evolutionary perspective, imagine the tiger's chasing you and you have to climb the tree to save your life. You need the carbs in the muscle for rapid energy. But for anybody who's a marathon runner, and I know you just ran a marathon, what happened at mile 20? Did you have your goo or your goop with you?
Yep. Yep.
That's because at mile 20, you exhausted your entire carbohydrate storage in your body. That's why you brought those. 4 hours, all of your stores were gone. But now compare that to protein. Unlimited fat storage capacity, limited carbohydrate storage capacity, no place to store protein in your body. Once you rebuilt your cells and made a little more fingernail and hair and made enzymes and hormones, at the end of the day, there's no place in your liver or your butt or your knee or your big toe where you say, oh, just in case I don't get enough tomorrow, I'm going to save some protein that I ate extra today over here. Nope. At the end of the day, you convert it to carbs. You can't sit on the couch and binge watch television eating protein bars and watch your muscles grow. So muscle growth is more than 90% working out and less than 10% how much protein you got. So if people just got those, like, no storage, the plants have all 20 amino acids. Oh my God, and the meats that I'm eating that have all the protein come with saturated fat and no fiber. Americans get half the fiber that's recommended and more protein than is recommended. The recommended dietary allowance of protein actually has a safety buffer. People complain about the number. It's 0.8 grams per kilogram body weight per day, or pounds. It's 0.36 grams of protein per pound of body weight. Athletes are saying 1 gram per pound. The RDA is 0.36, but actually the people who figured out protein requirements 50, 75 years ago said the average requirement is 0.3 grams of protein per pound body weight. But just to be sure, there's sort of a normal distribution of requirement. Some people need more, some need less. If we recommend the average requirement and everybody gets it, half the people will be deficient. So what we'll do is, as a population health approach, the RDA is set at 2 standard deviations above the average requirement. So that if everybody were to get the RDA, by definition, 97.5% of the population would meet and exceed their protein need. And so here's what I see in the average American. Oh, the RDA is this number, which is like 50 grams of protein per day. But I'm more than average. I'm going to need something on top of that. I'm going to have 70 or 80. but they end up eating 90. And the RDA already had a safety buffer. So you've got a safety buffer plus the extra that you ate and another safety buffer. And it's crazy. It's wackadoo. No one's deficient in protein. Competitive muscle building athletes don't need it. They get enough calories to get the extra protein they need. And when people obsess about it, they're not getting fiber. They're eating meat and they're eating bars and they're not getting the fiber they need for the microbiome. So the protein obsession is just wackadoodle right now.
And it's interesting that you say, I think a lot of people don't know that the protein, the excess protein gets converted into carbohydrates,
right?
Which I'm assuming if you don't burn that, then it goes into fat, right? So
it just turns into calories. Yeah. You're going ketogenic. So here's a funny thing for those. I'm sure everybody has tried or knows somebody on a ketogenic diet. And the main part of the ketogenic diet is a very, very low carbohydrate diet.
Mm-hmm.
So that you don't make any insulin to put the carbohydrate away. And most people don't know what the next step is. So when it's very low carb, you have to replace the calories with something. So a well-formulated ketogenic diet, read the book by Jeff Bullock and Steve Finney, is 70% fat. It's not high protein. So if you read it, it says very low carb, moderate protein, and a lot of fat. Because if you were to eat high protein, that would be converted to carb, which is the thing that you are cutting back on. So you would undermine what you were trying to do. And again, that's like, it seems obvious to some people who know that. And others like, oh, I was eating the meat because I know it's low in carb and I'm going keto. And it, to me, it's an excuse to eat meat when the true ketogenic diet is really, really high in fat, which is very hard to make that palatable. Like a 70% fat diet is pretty hard to put together and stick with. Most people I know can't do it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you can play with the word protein, you can play with the word carbohydrate, but the word fat literally is like, it's fat. So it's hard to change that into something that you can market as being, I guess, something that'll help you lose weight or whatever you might want to market.
It does work for some people, but here's what I think happens. I think the biggest concern is the added sugar in a refined grain, which is carb. So I think that people who are going keto, even when they're doing it wrong, are eliminating added sugar and refined carb. That is the most important thing. But you have to replace it with something. I would say replace it with nuts, seeds, legumes, Mediterranean, Asian soy and tempeh, Latin American, black beans and rice, and refried beans. There's so many Indian dals and lentils. There's so many cultures in the world that have beans or legumes as a staple, but they're high in carbs. So the people who fear carbs don't do that. And plus, we don't understand what legumes and pulses are. We don't have the words for them. But globally, that's what drives protein. Of all the plant foods, beans and legumes are higher in protein than anything else. So as a way, if you still want to be protein obsessed, you would look at Asian, Mediterranean, Latin, Indian culture, where they always had beans, peas, lentils as a staple.
So I had this question, and I think you've answered it. Somebody sent this in, and they said, I'm an athlete or I'm athletic. I'm not a professional, but I'm athletic. I do a lot of weightlifting. I'd rather have it, you know, is it better to have two chicken breasts rather than a bowl of beans? And I think you've answered my question here. So let me see if I've gotten this right. If my protein needs are met throughout the day and I'm eating two, three, whatever meat source it might be for protein, the excess is going to get converted into carbohydrates anyway. And so the beans may have carbs with the protein, but they've also got the fiber and other nutrients, whereas the meat doesn't have that. So I'm still getting the protein and the carbs, but none of the other benefits. So it's better to have the beans in general.
Yeah.
Then, right?
That's what I would say. So beans also, for a lot of people, can cause GI distress. So some of that fiber goes to your microbiome that chews it up and makes you fart, right? Mm-hmm. But if you adapt to that slowly, you can address some of that. You shouldn't eat just beans. You should have an Asian soy and tempeh dish. You should have a Mediterranean salad with hummus. You should have tacos or burritos with beans and whole brown rice. You should have an Indian dal or lentil dish that's got all kinds of veggies in it. So I wouldn't say just have a bowl of beans, but I have beans at most meals in one form or another. I'm drinking a soy milk latte right now. In the fridge, I've got a lentil chestnut soup that I made last night that I'll put cashews on top of later. The nuts have protein. The lentils have protein. The chestnuts have protein and other nutrients, antioxidants, fiber. Yeah, they're missing out on those aspects of a whole diet if they're just zeroing in on those chicken breasts.
Mm-hmm. And any weight loss associated, some people do high protein because they say it will help them lose weight, or that's how they maintain their weight. Again, I'm assuming that it comes down to the total calories that you're consuming, and that maybe part of it, I'm just going to guess, is psychological, but then also maybe if you're eating, I don't know, I'm just using chicken breast as an example, like four instead of, and then having a little salad, that's probably going to fill you up or make you feel more satiated. I'm not sure this is.
So the satiety world is quite odd. People always say protein is more satiating. I went to a protein symposium earlier this year, and a guy named Richard Mattis went over all the satiety data. He said there really isn't anything compelling that protein in the foods we eat is satiating. So it is true that if you were to add yogurt to your breakfast cereal that was just a sugary breakfast cereal with white bread, with jam on it, with a glass of orange juice, that was nothing but simple carbs. And then you added yogurt to it and a glass of milk with protein, that would be more filling, but partly because all you were getting before was carbs. So the fiber that comes with carbs actually draws water to it and causes physical distension of your stomach. That's part of satiety, is feeling full because you're stomach sensors are stretching. The fat in your diet floats to the top of your stomach during digestion, and it delays gastric emptying. So the fat has a satiety factor. So to be honest, protein and carbs and fats all have a satiety factor. And instead of gaming the system, you should just eat a diet that has all of them.
You
probably spend way too much time trying to game the system when really you should just put your spoon down one bite sooner toward the end. And by having one bite less, you will have eaten. Like the Asians have I'm blocking on the name of it. Hurry, hami, something. Sorry, eat till you're 80% full.
Mm-hmm.
They don't eat till they're 100% full. So eat till you're almost full. And after you stopped eating this, the hunger sensations go away pretty quickly. Eat slower. American youth these days just inhale their food. It takes 20 minutes for satiety signals to kick in. But if you ate those three slices of pizza, or if you ate that protein bar in a couple minutes, that's not even enough time for satiety signals to kick in. So I'm going to push back on protein being satiating. There isn't really great evidence for that. You'd really have to think it more in terms of which foods was I getting the protein from and what was I eating instead of. if it was instead of sugary breakfast cereal with white bread and jelly and a glass of orange juice, yes, almost anything was more satiating than that.
Okay. And I guess as we wrap things up, just a couple of quick questions, rapid fire, which I know is difficult. Seed oils, we mentioned them earlier. Are they bad?
Not at all. So okay. Much evidence. Yeah, forever. 2009 American Heart Association Science Advisory, 2017 American Heart Association Presidential Advisory, like the highest level of why are Americans confused? Here is all the evidence. We actually just debated with this wackadoodle thing about seed oil. Should we come out with a new statement? And somebody said, no, let's not give it more oxygen. There's no new evidence since 2017. We dealt with this 8 years ago, all the evidence available, and it was so compelling. Nobody's done any new studies. No, seed oils are fine. The place where they're wrong is we put a lot of seed oils in junk food. Mm-hmm. So in ultra-processed foods, so the American public's eating twice as much seed oil now, not because they're having more salads with salad dressing, not because they're more stir-frying, more veggies with seed oils. It's because they're eating more crap that has partially hydrogenated cotton seed oil in it, or heavily industrially processed safflower or sunflower. It's not that people are cooking at home with sunflower or safflower oil. Seed oils are fine. Industrially processed junk food, no good. Mm-hmm. If you get rid of them because of the seed oils, it won't be because of the seed oils, but I'll be happy because you got rid of them.
Okay. And then athletes, we hear, you mentioned it before, optimization. I think when people hear athlete, they say, oh, I do a lot of exercise, so I'm an athlete. And I'm wondering, you know, for somebody who's, let's say, doing a lot of exercise and they think they need more. We talked about this earlier, but they're comparing themselves to like a professional basketball player or a professional, you know, marathoner or something like that. Is the advice still all the same? Or I think people want to know, is there a secret to those elite athletes? And can I steal something? Are they doing something different than a normal, regular active person would need to do in their diet?
Yeah, no, not in their diet. They're working out 3 and 4 hours a day. So if you're prepared to work out 3 and 4 hours a day, you're going to eat more anyway, but you should pay more attention to your protein.
Okay.
But most people work out 3 or 4 times a week, not hours per day. So sorry, those aren't, they're athletic people, but they're not athletes. Because they're not working out that hard.
Well, I appreciate your time. I will just quickly add that I was in one of the blue zones, and I think the term blue zone is a little bit controversial, but I was in one area, I guess, in Costa Rica that's known as a blue zone. Mm. And I got to spend some time sort of outside of the cities and around farms and see what people were eating. And I noticed a lot of colorful plates, fruits, vegetables, some eggs, beans, and not a huge amount, like a good amount of food. And I was like, this, you know, and people were relaxed. They were outdoors. They were active. And I said, I don't know if there's really a secret that they have. It seems straightforward to me.
And a lot of that is social connection. The thing I like most about the Mediterranean diet is if you really dig into it, part of it is the afternoon siesta. It's hot. They take a 2 or 3 hour nap in the middle of the day. Is that a critical part of that blue zone in Crete to take a 3 hour nap because it's so hot? I think that's part of it. And the social connection and lower stress. So it's really not, there isn't a diet secret sauce. There's many good diets. Many. Humans are super versatile. But it is stunning how committed they are to playing around with all the wackadoodle things that there's no evidence for and probably are working against them if they would just simplify and enjoy the taste. My favorite new partners are chefs. I work with a lot of chefs. I'm trying to focus way more on the joy and pleasure of Mediterranean, Asian, Latin American, Indian foods and flavors. Then the biochemistry, which seems to drive people to pills and wacky superfoods.
Yeah. Where can people find you? Where can they find more good information about what to eat? Is there, socials?
So I have a lot of podcast things, so you can certainly Google me. My research group is at nutrition.stanford.edu. So that's pretty easy to remember. It actually flips to something else, but that works. Nutrition.stanford.edu. My favorite resource is not mine. It's the Center for Science and Public Interest, and it has a monthly newsletter called the Nutrition Action Health Letter. So this is a publication that one will pick. This is Diabetes Month. This is Heart Disease Month. This is Cancer Month. Two, here's the latest studies and how it fits into the rest of the literature. Three, here's our recipe of the month to give you something fun to cook. And four, we're not supporting protein bars, but of the protein bars, here's 50, and we're ranking them from the best to the worst protein bars. We're not pushing ice cream, but here's how we would rank ice creams and the best and the worst, because we know some of you are going to have a protein bar and some of you are going to have ice cream. So it's a really nice broad coverage on a monthly basis of lots of relevant things. And as soon as you sign up, you can look historically at all the other things they covered over the years.
I will leave links to all of those in the show notes, so where people can find those and sign up to the newsletter. Thank you again so much for your time. This has been very informative. I think a lot of people have so many questions, and there's so much online. You're just bombarded every time you go online with this, whatever it may be. I mean, it's really a lot, but I'm glad to hear that it's somewhat simpler than it might seem to be.
Okay, and hope my voice came through. Obviously, I'm losing my voice today, but it's actually better than it was yesterday.
Well, thank you for sharing just a little bit of what voice you have left with us. So I appreciate it. That was great.
All right. Take care.
Take care. Thank you again.
Thank you, Dr. Gardner, for being a guest on the podcast. And thank all of you for listening. Wherever you get your podcast, make sure you give us a 5-star review and a couple of kind words. It helps us get the word about the show out. And if you're watching on YouTube, make sure you hit the like and subscribe buttons. I'll have new videos for you every week. Thanks again for listening. Thanks again for watching. And I'll see you in the next episode.